Welcome to Sharing Science Radio. We're broadcasting from unceded Musqueam land on UBC's CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'm Alan Manning, and with me today is Tanya Rusi.
Hey, guys.
So what's on today? Well, hold down that sneeze, grab some crackers and cheese, and make yourself at ease, because we're talking about LEDs. So you're not too sure what these are? Well, you've seen LEDs before. They light up alarm clock numbers, computer and cell phone screens. They make your TV remote work. LEDs produce the laser light in your CD or Blu-ray player. And they are replacing incandescent and fluorescent light bulbs as the dominant form of indoor and outdoor lighting. Okay, big deal. How exciting can they be if they're just a fancy light bulb? I mean, who really cares? Well, today we're going to talk about the illuminating physics behind LEDs, why they are knocking the pants off other forms of lighting, how they are changing lives in developing countries, and the cast of characters that have been behind their research and development. These stories are coming up. First, let's talk about what makes LEDs different from other forms of lighting. Well, they're super efficient, and they convert almost all of the electrical energy into light. You know incandescent light bulbs? Those old school ones with the filament inside that heats up? These suckers lose most of the electrical energy as heat, and halogen bulbs aren't much better. Fluorescent lights are a bit more efficient, but today's LEDs are kicking their butts. LEDs can also produce light of very specific colors. They're cheap, they're durable, they're small, and unlike fluorescent lights, they don't have any delicious mercury vapor inside. Okay, so how do these guys work? Well, LEDs are an acronym for light emitting diode. Think everyone can understand the light emitting part, but diodes are an electrical component that only allow current to flow in one direction. Now, I bet you probably know that electricity is actually electrons moving around wires in a circuit. They go out one side of the battery and eventually come back in the other side. But in a diode, there are also things called holes. And a hole is just a space that an electron could fill, but doesn't. An electron and its hole are kind of like the last person to find a seat in a full movie theater. The person, that's like the electron, can move around. But the empty seat, and that's like the hole, can also move around too. Because if someone next to the empty seat switches into it, the empty seat has now moved. And electrons are negatively charged, and holes are positively charged. And like all oppositely charged things, they just want to be together. It's a high-energy situation to be apart. This subatomic romance is finally consummated by something called recombination. And the electron just sits right back into the hole, and the energy of the pair is lowered, and the energy difference is released as light or heat. And people have been improving LEDs for over 50 years, and they've really accomplished three important things in that time. First of all, the amount of heat released in recombination has been reduced significantly, because heat is generally not very useful. Second, the amount of light has increased. So during recombination, there's less energy emitted as heat and more energy emitted as light. And third and finally, the colors of light LEDs can produce now cover the whole visible spectrum and beyond. Okay, so if the physics is not enough to get you hot and bothered, Tanya is going to talk now about why these things are just such a big deal.
Thanks, Alan. Of course, we all know that physics is pretty important, but what really runs the world is money. And that's why LEDs are the future. Transitioning to LED lighting can save up to 20% of our global energy consumption. That's a huge savings, not just for the Earth and for the whales, but also in our pockets. Incandescent lights last an average of 1,000 hours, and compact fluorescent lights last around 8,000 hours. LEDs, on the other hand, can last 50,000 hours or longer. In terms of energy, a 60-watt incandescent bulb draws about $300 of electricity per year. A comparable compact fluorescent light will cost $75 a year, but the LED will only cost $30, and with less replacement cost, will cost less overall by a wide margin. For now, LEDs present a huge business opportunity, so investment is vigorous. Street lighting alone is a huge market, 140 million streetlights were installed in 2013, and only 14% of those were LEDs. For the companies which make the lights, this is an enormous market to tap into. For the cities paying the electricity, the switch to LED lighting is a no-brainer. 40% of the average city's electric bill goes to street lighting, and switching to LEDs can save between 30 and 70% in annual electricity costs. Add in the reduced maintenance and replacement cost, and LEDs are a pretty sweet deal. Forecasted sales and revenues in the LED markets are gigantic, with annual sales expected to double in the next decade. New York is in the process of replacing all their lighting at the price tag of $76 million, with an expected savings of $14 million per year, paying off the capital cost in only 5.5 years, then reaping the benefits for years to come. But we shouldn't forget what happened with incandescent bulbs. In the early days of the light bulb, manufacturers competed to create the longest-lasting bulbs. It was quickly realized that long-lasting bulbs weren't that great for continual sales, and manufacturers eventually settled on a design which would burn out after some time, part compromise between cost and effectiveness, and part planned obsolescence. Planned obsolescence, unlike the LED, is a truly American invention. I'll tell you more about the LED's Russian roots later.
Okay, great. Thanks for that, Tanya. Now, you mentioned that 20% of the world's electricity is used for lighting. There's an amazing picture you can look up. It's called The Earth at Night, and basically it's a picture of the Earth at night, and you can get a sense for just how much light that Earthlings, us humans, actually produce at night. And you can kind of see, like, oh, you know, South Korea's got a lot of lights, North Korea is completely black, and it's kind of fun to see what cities are associated with a lot of lights. But it really gives you an idea of just how important light actually is to people. I think many of us in the developed world don't think about this often enough. If you don't have light, you can't really cook that easily. You can't read. Your children can't do their homework. You can't really do any work beyond manual labor. You've pretty much got to shut things down as soon as the sun goes down. And then in the developing world, this is really the story for the over 100 billion people that lack access to grid electricity. And of course, you can have things like kerosene stoves or wood-burning fire that can provide some light, but these have their own problems. You know, it takes a long time to collect fuel, can be expensive, it's responsible for greenhouse gas emissions, and it really has horrendous indoor air quality. All right, now here's an idea. Let's take these awesome LED things that we've been talking about, these cheap, these inexpensive, these really bright LEDs. Let's hook them up to a solar panel and a small battery. And let's sell them or give them away in the developing world. And this is exactly what's being done, and it's really changing lives. For example, one village in Malawi, giving away a small LED lamp that could be charged by the sun, lowered the cost of lighting for the villagers by 85%. They could pay back the investment of a small LED lamp in less than a year. And crucially, here's the most important part, the number of hours that people lit up their homes more than doubled. This means that people are able to stay up longer, they're able to work longer, their children are able to study longer. This really increases and improves the quality of life for these people. I think this is an interesting example of how technology can actually leapfrog in the developing world. And what I mean by that is this. People who've never had access to electricity before, like this village in Malawi, they're not starting with incandescent bulbs. They're not starting with the crappy fluorescent bulbs. They are starting with the cream of the crop. They're starting with LED lights. Another example of this is cell phone usage. So cell phone usage in a lot of countries in Africa has grown tremendously. And also, cell phone usage has really led technological developments that aren't available in the developed world. For example, in Kenya, banking by cell phone is super duper common, and this is really a technology that's just starting to emerge in the developed world. And this is because cell phones, they can be cheap, they're durable, they last a long time, and they really change lives. They allow you to contact, stay in touch with your family, they allow you to do banking, they allow you to do all sorts of things that you couldn't do before. But even if you've never owned a landline phone, you can go right to owning a cell phone. And this is sort of the technological leapfrogging that LED lights can provide. And it's interesting. There's a quote by someone called Russell Sturm, who was quoted by the NPR when talking about LED lamps. And he said that we're so Americentric or Eurocentric that we think about innovations typically in terms of how they affect our own lives. But it's a whole other ballgame if you are spending 30% of your income to pay for kerosene so that your family can huddle around it and that kids can maybe get an hour's worth of studying in before it burns out. It's a whole different ballgame for these people. It's transformative. Well, that just about sums it up. And I think as technologies are pushed to become cheaper and more energy efficient, we're really going to be seeing more of their impact in the developing world. Okie dokie. Well, we're going to take a quick break now. And when we come back, Tanya's going to dive into the Russian Revolution. How does that tie in with LEDs? Well, don't go away.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of indigenous art from around the world. And guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
For magic, it gives me great pleasure to welcome each and every one of you to the final of the 422nd Quidditch World Cup. Let the match begin!
That's right, UBC has a Quidditch team and we're the fastest ones yet. Come join us at practice every Thursday at 5 and Sunday at 12 to show us your house pride. You can also get on our level with our Quidditch swag. We have bro tanks, t-shirts and sunglasses, all which go towards getting us to the World Cup. Not sure where to find the snitch? Well, like us on Facebook or check out our website at ubcquidditch.com and we'll be more helpful than you'll remember all. And remember, we want a nice clean game from all of you.
Welcome back to Sharing Science Radio on CITR 101.9 FM. Today we're talking light-emitting diodes, or LEDs. Tanya's going to tell us now how they have their roots in the Russian Revolution.
All right, cue the sad violin music. Oleg Vladimirovich Losev was born on a spring day in 1903 in Tver, Russia. When Oleg was just a year old, the new working class of the cities, who worked in horrific conditions, were united by a charismatic priest. They began to question their leaders, who made them suffer terribly. They organized, created demands, and went on strike throughout the cities. Soon, they decided to present a petition to the Tsar asking for improved working conditions, better wages, shorter work hours, and the introduction of universal suffrage. Unarmed and peaceful, thousands marched towards the Winter Palace to present the petition to the Tsar. The Tsar's soldiers charged on the marchers and shot them. Hundreds were killed. News of the massacre spread quickly, and the people were incensed. A revolution was sparked. Cries for a constitution, socialism, democracy, and freedom were heard in the streets. Oleg was born into a noble family, his father a retired captain of the Tsar's imperial army. His privilege put him on the wrong side of the revolution. The strikes, violent uprisings, and political upheaval continued. Oleg finished secondary school when he was 17, a few years after the First World War ended, amidst the chaos and terror of a civil war. The Bolshevik Revolution was marching forward. His future was uncertain. His ties to the nobility and recently overzoned Tsar meant he was banned from higher education by the Soviets. He found a job as a delivery boy for a radio institute and lived in the stairwell. Even though he was not allowed to attend university, he loved science and was a keen researcher. He attended a few courses, but was mostly self-taught and self-made. As long as his deliveries were complete, his colleagues, let him research in his spare time. He made many discoveries. In his short life, Oleg published 43 papers and was awarded 16 patents, almost all of them carefully detailing major discoveries. He invented the first solid-state semiconductor amplifier and generator. He observed light emission from semiconductor crystals. He discovered the LED and went on to comprehensively detail critical characteristics of the LED, along the way suggesting applications, like telecommunications, which we actually use today. He understood the diode's emission mechanism and used Einstein's quantum theory, very new at the time, to explain it. He touched on band theory before it had been developed and pushed the boundaries of our understanding at every step. He actually wrote to Einstein asking for help to develop the theory further, but Einstein didn't answer his letter. He made no money for all of his work because all of his discoveries belonged to the Soviet government. He struggled with poverty his whole life. He was eventually pushed out of his job at the Radio Institute. He moved to Leningrad, where he found a job as a lecturer in a medical institute, which wasn't as wonderful as it sounds. He was poor and wanted to continue his research. His dream was to become a researcher at one of the big institutes, but that was not to be. He managed to continue his research nonetheless. Shortly after publishing a paper about a device which could be a precursor to the transistor, he died of starvation in the siege of Leningrad. It was the middle of the Second World War. In death, he was just another corpse on the ground in a city littered with the dead. His work and accomplishments faded into obscurity. He was forgotten. Years later, American researchers were given the credit for discovering the LED. It wasn't until recently that his brilliant, pioneering work began to be recognized by the world at large.
Whoa, man, that's some pretty heavy stuff, Tanya. I had no idea that the discovery of LEDs was so emotionally wrenching. I heard last year, actually, the Nobel Prize was awarded to some people for an LED-related invention, and that there was also some emotional trauma around that. Not Leningrad-style trauma, but also a little bit of emotional trauma. Do you maybe think you can tell us about that?
Yeah, the Nobel Prize in 2014 in physics was awarded for the invention of the blue LED. The blue LED was a bit of a unicorn in the LED land. We were able to make red and green LEDs, but we needed blue to get the trifecta, allowing us to make white light cheaply. It was difficult for complicated technical reasons, but the story of the invention is also pretty interesting. One of the inventors, Shuji Nakamura, was from a small town in Japan. He got a master's degree in electrical engineering, but was advised not to move to the city and to a big company because he would never be able to afford a house. He stayed in his small town and joined a small company in the R&D department. The R&D department actually just consisted of him and one other guy. Basically, at his job, he was asked to produce all sorts of products, which meant he had to build the machines to make the products himself. He learned how to build chemical vapor deposition machines and all sorts of complicated technology to make semiconductors. He was frustrated in his job and wanted to do more research, but his bosses weren't having it. Finally, wanting to leave, he marched into his boss's office, asked for $33 million in funding, and a year off to go study in America to figure out how to build a blue LED. While his colleagues thought that was insane, the CEO said yes. He went to America to work with a professor who had a special way of growing semiconductors. Unfortunately, that professor had just lost all of his equipment in a turf war with another professor. All they were left with was spare parts. Nakamura worked 7 days a week, 10 hours a day, rebuilding the machine that he needed to learn from. It took him 10 months. Once he was done, he figured out how to grow the crystals he needed. He went back to Japan and started to innovate. His bosses wouldn't let him publish. While he was in America, he realized that all people really thought was important was having a PhD and publishing papers.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, that's about right. So he went back to Japan. His bosses wouldn't let him publish because they didn't want to give away their secrets, so he actually published secretly. He was innovating at a frenzied pace, publishing his results, and eventually he figured out how to make the golden unicorn of lighting, the blue LED. For this, and because he was smart enough to publish papers and get patents, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics 2 years ago.
Booyah. Nakamura, the man.
Yeah, he was actually pretty pissed off still at his employers at this point. So now he's a professor at University of Santa Barbara. After they took him, he sued his employers for compensation because they started making tens of millions of dollars more per year, but they were still paying him $100,000 per year. I think he ended up getting $8 million in the suit.
So he's got $8 million bucks, and he lives in California, and he's got a Nobel Prize, and he invented the blue LED.
Yeah, he's pretty set. Apparently, he doesn't really like the idea of reading textbooks or working with grad students or teaching, but other than that, he's pretty set.
Wow, that's quite the story. It's interesting how when the Nobel Prizes come out, there's always some interesting tidbits that emerge because as such a coveted prize, and with most research projects involving so many people, there's always a question of who gets the credit.
Yeah, and in this case, there's no question because he really did do it all himself. But it's just incredible that he managed to pull it off.
Yeah, that's quite a story. Now, you mentioned earlier that blue LEDs were the golden unicorn, so to speak, the land narwhal, the last piece of the trifecta. Now, why is that? You said that it was easy to make red and green LEDs. Why do we need blue LEDs?
Well, there's a couple reasons. For one, if we have red, green, and blue LEDs, then we can combine them to make white light.
Okay, so wait. White light is made up of red, green, and blue?
Yep.
Okay, but if you mix paints together and you mix red and green together, you get brown.
That's right, but that's because paints absorb light, whereas mixing the light paints interfere with each other constructively.
Well, that's interesting. Well, you know, if our listeners don't believe us, first of all, they should email us at radio@ubcsharingscience.org. But I would also recommend that you listeners try out this experiment. You can take a magnifying glass to your computer screen, and you can see that all the individual pixels are made up of red, green, and blue, thus
RGB.
Making white light. Yep.
On top of that, the wavelength of blue light is shorter, or shortest in the visible spectrum. I guess violet is a little bit shorter. But the shorter wavelength really expands the applications. So, for example, if you're using an LED laser or an LED light in a CD drive, the length of your wavelength limits how much data you can read or how much data you can physically put into some space. The shorter the wavelength, the more data you can put and the more stuff you can stick on your Blu-ray CD.
Oh, okay, so that's why we have Blu-rays now. But yeah, and I think the original CD was like red light, and then DVDs was sort of green light with a slightly shorter wavelength. And now we've got Blu-ray discs, which are just cramming on the data like nobody's business.
Eventually, if we just stick X-rays in there, we'll have tons of data and really poor health.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Tons of data and really poor health, which we kind of already do, I think.
Yeah. Isn't that true?
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about where LEDs are used. I'm just actually looking at something right now. There's an optical mouse, and it looks like it's lit with a super bright LED. But we didn't really touch on one area I think that's quite important, and that is communications.
Yeah, LEDs can be used in telecommunications because unlike a regular light bulb, which you can only switch on and off as fast as your hand can go, or as fast as the filament can respond, you can modulate an LED at any kind of communication frequency like 10,000 kilohertz, which is 10,000 switches per second.
So it's turning on and off 10,000 times a second.
That's right, yeah. Or any kind of telecommunications frequency, and you can propagate that modulated light or the on and off really fast switching light down an optical fiber and out the other end, and that can carry your message like Morse code.
Oh, okay. So is that what a lot of optical fibers use?
I think the newest ones do use LEDs. In the old days, I think that they were using lasers, which are super expensive. But we don't really need the special features of a laser, really, for optical,
okay,
for
right.
optical
so
communications.
Okay, so for like a short, if you have a short enough fiber, then any light will do as long as you can turn it on and off fast.
Yeah, yeah. Lasers have a special thing called coherence, and they have a really long coherence length, and you just don't really need that when you're shoving it into a fiber.
Right, right.
You do need that if you're propagating the light through air for some distance.
Okay, so they're using it in telecommunications as well. Do they use it outside optical fibers?
Yeah, they actually use this, for better or for worse, they're using modulated LEDs to advertise to you now. So certain stores have installed LED lighting instead of regular lighting, and then they're switching it on and off too fast for you to see, but fast enough for your phone to see, and they're actually sending you advertisements while you're in the store.
Okay, but your phone has to be enabled to pick these advertisements up, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a developing technology that they're still working on. I don't think most of us would be able to see those advertisements, but I'm sure eventually with the right contract signed and the right back scratched, that will be a thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I just saw something about, this is kind of going off topic, but I just saw something about ad block and how like it's like causing advertising companies like $20 billion or $30 billion in lost revenue.
I love ad
this
block.
Year. Yeah, AdBlock is amazing.
Install it and donate to the creator.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I can't imagine that there would be things like that on your phone that you could not work around. I mean, consumers don't want advertisements. And on systems where you can write software, you can always write software to get around that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But you'd be surprised at the amount of people who don't use AdBlock. Like my mother or my boyfriend or a bunch of other people who just think that it's like too much trouble to somehow click a link and download it, or they don't trust that it's not stealing their data. So there's still people who will take the advertisements.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, anyways, I'm not too worried about LED advertisement infiltration.
No, me neither. I'll survive.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so some nefarious purposes for LEDs as well. Who knows?
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to mention one cool thing about LEDs, and that is the fact you can actually use them as a solar cell in reverse.
Yeah, of sorts. I mean, you can shine light on an LED and get a little voltage across the terminals. I've used that as a sensor before when I was building little robots in my undergrad.
Yeah, that's right. So we talked earlier about holes and electrons and how in an LED, these things are constantly recombining to emit light. And in a solar cell, basically all you're doing is you're taking a little packet of light called a photon, and you're whacking it into an electron, and that electron jumps away from its hole, and now you've got a hole and electron pair. You've got a positive and negative charge, and that produces electricity. So that's actually kind of cool because, the same physics in reverse can be used to make a light, or it can be used to make light from electricity, or it can be used to make electricity from light. Just kind of neat. No, obviously these things are optimized, but you can actually detect a small voltage from LEDs if you hook them up backwards.
Yeah, it's really awesome. One of the beautiful symmetries in physics.
One of the many symmetries in physics. But I think that's a show for another day. We're going to wrap things up here. We've been talking about LEDs on Sharing Science Radio with myself, Alan.
And me, Tanya.
And next week, we're going to be discussing... That was Tanya's dolphin. That's what we're talking about. They're dolphins. Dolphins imitating humans.
And humans imitating dolphins.
That's right. Yep. We'll be discussing them. So thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard, had any questions, or just want to drop us a line, we would love to hear from you. You can reach us at the following email address, radio@ubcsharingscience.org. That's radio@ubcsharingscience.org. Thanks a lot for listening. Up next on CITR is Sam Squanch's Hideaway.
If you email us, we'll send you a free dolphin.
Or at least a recording of Tanya's dolphin call.
You've been troubled. You've been broke, you've been hungry, no job, no